Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, April 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering a Master of Social Work with a variety of scholarships and funding options. Adelphi.edu/HudsonValleyMSW. Joining us today is Dr. Matthew Lining. Dr. Lining is an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center who treats disorders including thyroid disease, pituitary disease, diabetes, adrenal disease, and osteoporosis. If you want to get a call in, do it early. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or email us, voxpop@wamc.org. It's voxpop@wamc.org. Or 800-348-2551. We'll meet Dr. Lining and take your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us today is Dr. Matthew Lining. Dr. Lining is an endocrinologist at Albany Med who specializes in endocrine disorders in adults, including thyroid disease, pituitary disease, diabetes, adrenal disease, and osteoporosis. He completed a fellowship in endocrinology and metabolism at St. Mary's Hospital Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and completed a residency in internal medicine at Greenwich Hospital in Connecticut. He earned his medical degree from Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. If you have a question for Dr. Matthew Lining, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Matthew Lining, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm very glad you're here today. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned several things that I associate with endocrine disorders, and then there was osteoporosis. And before we get to the emails, and we have some already, and the calls, I thought osteoporosis was a bone thing. How does that tie in with endocrinology?
Well, I'll tell you, but first let me say I finally get to meet you, Mr. Graff.
Really? I've
been a fan of yours for a while now.
Are you sure you got the right station?
I think so.
Okay,
this
man.
Is WQXR, isn't
well,
it?
Yeah, no. Might as well, close enough. Hey, thank you for
All
being
right.
here.
All right. Yes, osteoporosis is a problem with bones, but a good 800 years ago, there were some smart people trying to figure out, well, why is it that we see these little old ladies breaking bones? What's going on? And they looked into metabolism of bone and found out that in that case, it was mostly elderly women who had lost estrogen, and that estrogen is, in fact, very important for bone health. So it became an endocrine problem because endocrinologists deal with hormones. So my fellow orthopedists, when you break a bone, they'll fix it, they'll pay attention to it, they'll replace your hip, but they don't do anything to prevent or actually treat the osteoporosis.
Well, you know, my wife and I are of the age that we're slinging back the calcium citrate now, and it's hoping not to be little old people. Is there a danger in taking that sort of supplement?
It would be very hard to get yourself in trouble by taking calcium. You would have to take a whole lot of it. The worst thing you might get initially is sometimes the calcium compounds are constipating. The citrate, not so much. So yeah. It's good to take the citrate.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to tell you. You might want to just turn the phone off there. Unless you have to go for surgery or something, in which case, go ahead. I'll cover the show myself.
No, I think it was probably spam.
All right. Fair enough. Well, we get a lot of that around here. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Dr. Matthew Lining from Albany Med joins us today. We talk endocrinology. See a lot of ads on TV these days for diabetes meds and everything else. One of the things that I don't think was really even around, maybe it was in its infancy 20 years ago, is these continuous glucose monitoring devices. How has that changed the game for you?
It has become an enormous game changer, specifically for people with type 1 diabetes or those people with type 2 diabetes who are insulin requiring. When we had the glucose meters where you would prick your finger, you know, we had to convince people to do a lot of finger sticks every day. They were painful, annoying. You'd have to write them down. You'd have to carry this bulky meter with you, bigger than a cell phone generally.
Yep.
And we just didn't have enough information to know how to adjust some of the insulin. And for the individuals taking insulin, they have to know every time they take a dose of insulin how much they should give. And if you're working with insufficient data, you're kind of going blind. Well, now with the CGMs, we have continuous feedback. So we can look at any point and say, oh, I'm about to eat a meal, but my blood sugar is already starting, you know, a little higher or a little lower, so I'm going to make some adjustments that way.
Now, when you say we, you mean the patients, or does that info go directly, the telemetry go directly to your office?
Well, what we can do as providers is we can access, from the cloud, the individuals can load with some of the devices they can load, and then we can read it once they give us permission. Also, when they come into the office to see us, we can download the information off the device and get a lot of historic data, but it tells us about trends. It points out the impact that people may have with certain levels of exercise, certain kinds of food they eat, et cetera. And now, of course, these devices can be hooked up to the insulin pumps in what's called a hybrid semi-closed loop, so that the insulin pump itself has a very complicated algorithm in it that helps determine, you know, almost minute by minute how much insulin to provide.
You know, I watched I saw this over the weekend when I was watching sports. The commercial was a woman is checking her, you know, she has the device, this continuous device, and she's looking on her phone, and the blood sugar goes way down, and she drinks a little juice and it goes back up. And I said, geez, does it work that quickly? Does the blood sugar really go back up that quickly?
Well, not quite. So it's not going to happen while you're watching the commercial. When you ingest some glucose or something to get your blood glucose up, there's a good 5-minute lag or so.
Yeah.
But it can be relatively quick. If you're symptomatic, it can seem pretty quick.
Dr. Matthew Leining joins us today, an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Barbara in Ulster County wrote in this morning, and she writes, I'm 72. Since I was a teenager, sudden bursts of activity like running to catch a bus or rushing around to be on time for something or even getting overheated wearing too heavy a jacket has made me feel shaky and weak. It feels like my blood sugar has dropped and I need to eat. I try to eat protein. If I eat carbs or sweets, I'm sure to have what feels like another blood sugar crash after 30 minutes or so. I also get quite weak when I'm hungry, say between breakfast and lunch. My most recent non-fasting blood test indicates I'm pre-diabetic. I've wondered if I'm hypoglycemic. I don't understand how you can be hypoglycemic and also pre-diabetic. Also, Doc, do you have any thoughts on what this condition may be and what diagnostic steps and treatments are indicated? Should I see an endocrinologist? And that's from Barbara in Ulster County.
Okay, so there's a bunch of points that are brought up.
Do you want the paper?
Nope.
Okay.
I think I got it.
All right.
It is unusual for people to become truly hypoglycemic in the absence of some sort of a concurrent illness or a place where we actually see it a fair amount is post-bariatric bypass surgery.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that physiologically, hypoglycemia can, you know, pretty much kill you quickly because the brain needs a continual supply of glucose. That's the energy that the brain is using. So if you turn that off for even a couple of minutes, you can have a stroke, coma, et cetera. So the body has multiple redundant methods to maintain the blood sugar in a reasonable range. And if it didn't, mammals, et cetera, we wouldn't be around anymore. We wouldn't have survived. Now, this question of, well, are people getting hypoglycemic has been looked at very, very heavily over the past 50, 60 years. There was, in fact, a number of studies were being done just prior when I was at Mayo Clinic, and they and some other people at Yale were looking very, very closely at this. And what they found out was when we call a glucose normal, we used to say, 70 to, 100, 110.
Yeah.
What they found out was that especially in young women, a normal glucose is actually much lower. It may be down as low as 50, 55. And when they tried to correlate the symptoms that someone was having with actual low glucose, right, they could not get the correlation there. So people were sensing as if they were hypoglycemic, but they were not physiologically hypoglycemic.
Yeah.
It's something they call Whipple's triad. You have to have an actual measurable low glucose, symptoms that occur at the same time, and then the symptoms respond immediately to the administration of glucose.
So what was going on?
Well, they came up with different terms for it. They came up with reactive postprandial syndrome, because a lot of times it would happen like 2 to 4 hours after a meal.
Yeah.
They looked at a number of Air Force recruits, for example. This was one study, and they put them through basic training. And they were trying to say, well, are these people getting hypoglycemic? They were getting hypoglycemic from the standpoint of blood glucose less than 70, but still, you know, greater than, let's say, 50 or 55. But physiologically, they were not having the response that you would see with true hypoglycemia. So for lack of a better term, we just tell people, well, it's sort of reactive or it's a postprandial syndrome, but we don't want to call it hypoglycemia because it isn't true hypoglycemia. And what we notice is that it changes in people. We see someone and then how you're doing 20 years later, usually it's like, oh, well, that was there for a while. It kind of resolved on its own, didn't continue to be a problem. We also tell people, listen, if you're symptomatic, play around with your diet a little bit, all right? So if you're feeling low in the middle of the afternoon, maybe eat a little less at lunch, but have a snack in the middle of the day. And if that seems to make you feel better, then go with it.
You know, you mentioned, we're going to have to take a break here, but you mentioned that in the study of women, you found that, okay, the low number was lower than normal, was lower than you thought it would be. Is the high number ever higher than you? In other words, is it more individual per patient? What's a healthy and safe glucose level?
No, it's pretty standard from one person to the next. Now, there are instances such as where people have tumors that make insulin and then they can truly get low blood sugar, or people with diabetes who are on insulin and get a lot of unintended low blood sugars, then those thresholds can actually move a little bit. And if people are high all the time, they can also then move up a little bit. But those thresholds don't move by very much at all, maybe
10
or 20 milligrams per DL. That's the unit.
Gotcha. Dr. Matthew Leining's our guest. We are overdue for a break. We'll take a quick one here. We'll get back to the phones and the emails in a moment. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. Kind of like interstitial music for a cop show, but no, it's Medical Monday today. Dr. Matthew Leining is our guest from Albany Med. It's endocrinology at 800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Tell you what, Doc, two more emails for now, and then we'll hit the phones. This one's from John in the 845. My cardiologist has had me on levothyroxine for years, but I've never known exactly why. Any ideas?
Yeah, levothyroxine is thyroid hormone. That's the chemical name for it. So the thyroid makes thyroid hormone. There's actually two components. One's called T4, one's called T3. Levothyroxine is T4. Your body converts it to T3. That's a little beyond what we need to get into, but it's fairly easy to diagnose hypothyroidism. Even if it's mild, the blood tests are very good to pick it up. So there's plenty of non-endocrinologists out there who are treating people for hypothyroidism and giving them levothyroxine.
Okay. And so, all right. Fair enough. This email from Anonymous. I have to be specific about that. She does not want her name. Writes, my teenage daughter's hairy. 10 laser hair removal treatments, handled maybe half. So she doesn't look simian, but she already has coarse hairs on her chin, something women see peri and post-menopause. Should she be evaluated for a hormonal problem? And that's from Anonymous.
Yeah, so what's being described here we call hirsutism, which just means excess hair growth.
Yeah.
You know, most women don't look like the women in the sportswear issue of Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
So hair removal products are big business. It doesn't hurt at one point in your life if you feel like, geez, maybe I'm hairier than I should be.
Yeah.
To have it checked out. There's a few simple hormone levels that can be checked. It's very common syndrome called polycystic ovary syndrome, in which androgen levels are a little bit above normal, but not anywhere near a dangerous range. Women with polycystic ovary syndrome typically have hirsutism, acne. They tend to be overweight. They have some menstrual irregularities. Those things all tend to clump together.
Mm-hmm. Will weight loss alleviate a lot of that?
It will help in polycystic ovary syndrome, yes. Of course, the difficulty is, you know, you can't just say, oh, we'll lose some weight and find that it's easy. If that were the case, we wouldn't have overweight people around.
And we wouldn't see all those ubiquitous ads for these weight loss drugs. Where do you stand on that?
Right. So this is very interesting. All these drugs are in a class that are called GLP-1. It stands for glucagon-like peptide type 1. And the way they were discovered is someone was studying the spit of the Gila monster.
What?
The lizard, yes. No, I'm not making this up. The Gila monster in the Southwest, who eats a meal once every 2 months and then otherwise just kind of hangs around doing nothing other than digesting it. So this researcher, NIH, found this compound called Exendin and said, you know, this might be useful because it has impact on blood glucose levels and such. So he played around with it, came up with this Exendin, which is a form of this GLP-1. And it turns out that when you give it to humans, it suppresses appetite, often leads to a significant amount of weight loss. It helps bring blood glucose levels down. And now these are the drugs you hear about, like Ozempic and Trulicity and Mounjaro and Wegovy and so forth.
Yeah.
So initially marketed for diabetes and now are spreading into the obesity area.
And you all right with that?
Well, here's the issue. When you stop taking the drug, the weight tends to come back.
Yes.
So is this really going to be a lifetime drug? The first GLP-1 that was marketed was something called Byetta. You had to take it twice a day back in 2005, I think. So we haven't had people on these drugs for even 20 years yet.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, yes, it's exciting that, you know, I've seen them lose significant amount of weight, but really a lifelong drug for that? So
I mean, it seems like a philosophical thing, maybe in this country only, or maybe throughout the West, you know, you're looking for a shortcut, basically.
Right.
That's the bottom line, right?
Right. And there are some potential problems with this class of drugs. So there was a big trial, and we actually participated in it, where they took these drugs and they took people at risk for heart disease,
yeah,
for heart attacks, people, a high-risk population who also had diabetes. And when they gave the drug to people, they found out, oh, look, we decreased heart attacks by, I don't know, 10, 20, 30%.
Well, that's pretty good. Ballpark,
over a three-year period. But here's the thing. There's a concept in medicine when you're doing these trials called number needed to treat. And that's just how many people do you have to treat in the conditions for this trial in order to prevent one event. So in other words, if I tell you I have a drug that is going to decrease the death from this disease by 50%, but only one in a million people get it.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Right. So the absolute numbers then are very high. So the number needed to treat in this trial over 3 years to prevent one event was the same as the number needed to harm for needing gallbladder surgery.
Ha. Huh. So really?
So would you rather have a heart attack or gallbladder?
No, I'd rather not have a gallbladder, frankly.
Well, so my point is that when you start giving some of these medicines, which in specific trials can look effective and helpful, when you start expanding to the general population, you may uncover some things that are not going to be there till you've given it to thousands and thousands of people.
So with regard, and we have to hit the phones, 800-348-2551, Dr. Matthew Leining from Albany Med joins us today. With regard to these drugs that are now being marketed as weight loss drugs, have they been studied enough that you feel comfortable? In other words, you said, well, we've only been doing this X number of years. You need 20 years to really look at the data and see if you're on this for a lifetime, whether it's going to be detrimental.
Yeah. So, yes, the companies are doing a lot of phase four marketing. In other words, they're trying to, you know, push the edge of it. And they do trials in a specific set of population, thinking that, oh, we can get an FDA indication for this or et cetera. And with these trials, I'm feeling a little more comfortable. But what I'm doing is still pretty much sticking to the people where the trials were shown to actually have a benefit. So I'll give it to someone who has diabetes if they're overweight or if they have, you know, potential heart problems. If I don't see them lose weight, then I'm going to take them off the medication because not everyone loses weight on the ones that we're talking
Interesting.
About.
Interesting. Why do some people not lose weight?
It's unclear. Some of the newer ones that are out are at higher doses and seem to be a little bit more effective for weight loss. So the first ones that we were using for diabetes, we certainly saw some people lose weight, but then we also saw some people really not lose much in terms of weight. So in those instances, I'll say, hey, look, this is an expensive drug. I don't think it's really doing for you what we think it is, so let's pull it back because I've got so much else that I can use to treat. Or if someone is significantly overweight and I can see that it is causing health problems, whether they're orthopedic type issues or whatever, I'll say, yeah, this might be worth a try.
Interesting. All right, Dr. Matthew Leining, we're going to go to the phones now. 800-348-2551. We begin in Clifton Park. Beth, you're on.
Oh, hi. So my doctor, my primary, sent me to an endocrinologist because he suspected I had diabetes insipidus due to a low ADH hormone level at less than 0.08, and I was urinating about 20 times in a 24-hour period. The endocrinologist said that because I had good osmolality, that she wasn't thinking that that was it, and that was the end of what she was willing to consider. So anyway, I went back to primary. He put me on desmopressin, and now I'm, you know, urinating normally. But then I ended up having all my electrolytes washed out because I was drinking too much, and it was kind of a mess. But I just wonder, is that an adequate way to diagnose diabetes insipidus? Somebody said that you needed to really do a water deprivation test to get that diagnosis.
Yeah, so
I'd appreciate your input.
And for the listeners, let me just clarify some things that they may not have followed. There's diabetes mellitus and diabetes insipidus. They both make you urinate frequently. If your blood sugar's high, it's an osmotic diuresis that you're getting. And diabetes insipidus is just a problem with free water regulation, where a hormone called antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, made by the pituitary is either not being made by the pituitary or the kidneys are not responding to it. So it's totally separate from diabetes mellitus. It's also much, much, much less common. The water deprivation test, in other words, if someone's drinking a lot and peeing a lot, it's a chicken and an egg. Well, are they peeing a lot because they're drinking a lot, or are they drinking a lot because they were peeing a lot? And sometimes you can't make that distinction without, as I like to tell my medical students, tickle the system and see if it laughs. So the water deprivation test is to try to exaggerate any physiologic abnormalities that are there so that then you can detect them. So if we tell someone who's urinating a lot, well, we're not going to let you drink. All right. What happens is normally they would concentrate the urine so that they're not losing any free water. They would become thirsty as all get out, and you could measure serum and urine osmolality. That's the term that you use there. And there's a very narrow range that's normal for serum urine osmolality. And so, yes, the water deprivation test is the way, the gold standard way to say, oh my goodness, you do have a problem with either ADH function or kidney function or the pituitary.
Mm-hmm. All right, Beth.
So I should, it sounds like I need to go to another endocrinologist who can do this for me because everybody seems to be not doing anything.
Yeah. On the one hand, taking small amounts of desmopressin, which is a chemical that is very similar to antidiuretic hormone, can work. But there are some potential issues. You can actually get water intoxication if you're taking too much and drinking too much. Again, that's not a problem, but that can also be threatening. So if, for your own benefit, if you really want to know what the situation is, yeah, I would suggest it might be a good idea to do the water deprivation test.
Beth, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Matthew Leining joins us from Albany Medical Center. And now to Hudson. Jennifer, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, Dr. Leining. I actually have two questions. One of them really quick. I'm just wondering, when you take levothyroxine or any other thing for thyroid disease, why do you have to wait 30 minutes for that precious cup of coffee with milk in it? I'm just curious as to what is actually going on that makes that necessary. And my second question is, I just had one of our cats treated with this thing called ThyroCat, where he received a radioactive iodine injection in order to kill the thyroid tumor and cure him. We don't know if he's cured yet, but he's recuperating very well. And I'm just curious if this can be done for people.
Okay, so the first question. Thyroid hormone absorption can be affected by other foods. So if you take your levothyroxine pill with other food, you're going to impair absorption in your intestine by 10 to 20%. Now, that's why they say take it on an empty stomach and wait. But, you know, what I tell my patients is, as long as you're taking it the same way every day, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Because if you take it with that cup of coffee, I may have to up your dose a little bit. But if you're taking it the same way every day, fine. I that thyroid hormone comes in like 15 different sizes of pills. So we can adjust it. So I tell people, just do it the same way every day and get a steady state. And then we can make the adjustments so that your thyroid hormone level is normal.
Now, the second part of that, do you do a lot of veterinary work, Doc?
I actually don't.
No, I thought so.
But I have had, I'm down to one cat at this point.
Yeah, me too.
Who's like 21 years old. And
ooh, that's a good run.
And he's getting a little, he's got Alzheimer's, I think. He's a little funky. But
it's
very interesting,
yeah.
Because cats do get thyroid disease. There are certain diseases in humans that don't seem to show up in other mammals and such, but cats do get thyroid disease, and you can treat with radioiodine. Now, why does this even work? Because it works because thyroid hormone, the chemical, actually has iodine molecules in it. It's part of that levothyroxine pill,
yeah,
or thyroid hormone that you make. So the thyroid has a special protein that traps iodine in the blood and incorporates it into the thyroid to turn it into thyroid hormone. So if we give a small dose of radioactive iodine, you know, that we can read with a gamma camera, we can assess thyroid function and we can get a functional picture of the thyroid. If we give a thousandfold higher dose, we can actually treat hyperthyroidism because then the iodine is trapped and the local radioactivity destroys some cells and destroys and damages the DNA so that the thyroid cells can't reproduce. So if you do it in a cat, same thing as humans, it's going to take weeks to maybe a couple of months to really kick in and work.
Huh.
And then after that, your cat will very likely have to go on thyroid hormone because there's really no perfect dose that just gets rid of the extra thyroid function and leaves, you know, normal thyroid function behind. That's putting, you know, dancing on the edge of a roof and thinking you can stay there.
Yeah, don't do that. Jennifer, you want to follow up?
That's all really fascinating. Thank you so much for the answers.
Thanks.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Dr. Yeah. Matthew Leining joins us. One more call before the next break. Let's go to Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
One effect does stress have on endocrine function?
Stress? Okay.
Okay. Stress can have a big effect on a lot of systems in the body. It clearly affects immune function. Some of the problem we see with endocrine systems can be autoimmune problems. We certainly see people with diabetes, sometimes under heavy stress. I've had patients that, you know, can see their blood sugars being affected by stress. There's a lot of literature going back over 100 years at Graves' disease, which is a thyroid hyperactivity autoimmune problem. can be triggered by stress. So the answer is yes. And it's hard to sort these out because stress in one person is not exactly the same as stress in another person. So
that's a good point. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Now, we mentioned at the outset of the show this continuous glucose monitoring. With regard to something like that and an effect on diabetes, do these continuous streams of data, will they give you insights into any nature of, about this illness going forward?
Well, yes and no. It's going to tell us in an individual how they tend to respond, let's say, to a certain level of exercise or certain level of stress or what might happen in the menstrual cycle. But what I can tell you is, you know, for decades for doing this, everyone is a little bit different. And so I have some women whose menstrual cycles really mucks things up, and in other women it's like no impact at all.
Interesting.
So
let's take a quick break. Dr. Matthew Leining joins us. It's Medical Monday, as you might have surmised. We'll be back. Dizzy Gillespie here on our bumper music. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Matthew Leining from Albany Medical Center. It's Endocrinology Today, and this is odd email came in from Brad. Dr. Leining, when are you going to return to baseball? What does that mean?
this is probably a colleague of mine. I was playing here in the Men's Senior Baseball League for years.
You're kidding me.
Up until COVID, and COVID really... you know, trying to get out of work in time to get to the field.
Yeah.
And then they would not have a game. And then that meant the next day I couldn't go because I couldn't get out early.
Right.
I'd have to do work. And so also my vision changed and now I've got bifocals. And what I found out is I put those on and I become very clumsy.
Interesting.
I start, you know, because your peripheral vision and stuff is not there. And so it was affecting on the ball field, you know, following the baseball and that kind of stuff.
What were you playing? What position?
Mostly outfield,
yeah.
And I also pitched.
Yeah, you know, you always want a pitcher with good vision. I think that's that's a plus. You know, did you wear the sports goggles?
No, did not wear the sports goggles. Because, again, they wrap around, they change the vision over on the sides.
Oh, you should have tried them. My son tried. He eventually had to get a minor prescription, and he got the sports goggles. Almost killed the third base coach with a liner down the line, the first at bat. It makes a difference. All right, let's go to something more medical-oriented here. This is from Wanda. I once worked for a famous endocrinologist, Dr. Louis E. Braverman. Right now, the biggest problem I see is that people who need to see an endocrinologist can't find one. Example, my son-in-law has an A1C of 11. He lives in Michigan near the University of Michigan Medical School. His primary care doc can't seem to get him in to see an endocrinologist. Why is there such a shortage in your specialty?
Okay, so good question. And the first thing is Lou Braverman, yes, he was a famous endocrinologist in Boston area, has a textbook that he had written and edited, and now someone else has had to take that over. And I knew Lou Braverman. He was a really nice guy. Died of old age, so he had a nice life.
Yep.
All right, and the first question was, why are there so few endocrinologists? I think part of the problem is we're sort of at the bottom of the pecking order in terms of pay scale. If you look at subspecialties and so forth, we're down there with, you know, pediatric infectious disease and a few other things. So for an extra couple of years of training, you get less than I would get as an internist who's a hospitalist. And it's just the economics of it.
Given the prevalence of diabetes in this country, how can that be?
Because the payment systems are not designed for encouraging people to spend the time to work with people who have diabetes and work with all the technology and so forth. It's a busy visit when you're going over the data, even from the CGMs, and you're looking at the trends and looking at all these things. This is not a 5-minute visit. It's a long visit, and the codes that you put in for reimbursement do not value that as highly as almost everything else.
So really, this is an insurance company thing.
Yeah, well, we're talking... before we came in about the economics of what's going on. We have a fee-for-service system in this country that basically everything is geared towards that fee at that service and maximizing that, the gain between the people charging, the people paying, and then stuck in the middle is the patient.
Yep.
So it's not always being done what's the best for the patient. So there is a shortage in terms of people with diabetes. Only about 5 to 10% of people with diabetes get to see an endocrinologist.
You know, I admire you continuing this, but I have a feeling the publicity person here is looking askance at this line of questioning. So let's move on. This is from Marion in Franklin County. I had one adrenal gland removed due to a benign tumor. My blood sugar returned to normal. Should I use no salt or restricted amounts?
Okay, so fortunately, humans and primates can get by with one adrenal gland. Now, the adrenal makes a couple of compounds. One of them is aldosterone, which regulates salt in the body. And the best way to answer that question would be, number one, do you have hypertension? Because many people are salt sensitive if they're hypertensive. If you're not hypertensive, you can probably get away with eating as much salt as you would like, because the body will regulate the amount of salt that you retain. Mm. So if you're not hypertensive, it's probably perfectly fine to just go ahead and eat.
All right. Tell you what, let's go to one more email and then back to the phones. I got to be honest with you. There are so many emails and so many calls that we will have to do this again fairly soon.
Sure.
Don in Amsterdam writes, my mother's now in a nursing home at the wonderful age of 87. She's been a diabetic for 72 years. The home is struggling to control her levels. Can a person become insulin resistant over time? She still has all her fingers and toes, no missing digits or limbs. And that's from Don in Amsterdam.
So congratulations to your mother for living so long on insulin. Lilly, one of the companies that makes insulin, was giving out awards to people that lived 50 years on insulin. So I think they're still doing that.
Cash awards?
Yeah. Well, they just, it's a plaque kind of thing.
And, okay.
You know, yeah. Right. It sounds as if your mother might be a person who could benefit from CGM and perhaps hooked up with a pump. The question that was asked was, do people become insulin resistant?
Yeah.
Insulin resistance is a hallmark of type 2 diabetes. Yet there's some overlap, because someone who develops type 1 can also have a family history of type 2 and therefore also develop insulin resistance.
Yeah, you can get it both. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It just means you have to treat with more insulin.
Interesting.
Insulin always works. It's just a matter of how much.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines. Dr. Matthew Lining's our guest from Albany Med, and let's go to Albany. And Eileen has been waiting a half an hour. Eileen, go ahead.
Hi there. Listen, two parts, kind of. Many years ago, after a couple of DEXA scans, I was told I was, you know, on borderline osteoporosis, and I was given Evista, although it was really rifloxamine. Mm-hmm. And I took it for a while, and that was my first prescription drug of my life. I'm 72. And I just said, well, you know, I was sporadic when I remembered. And then I had another one, and they said, oh, about the same. And then I didn't take any for 2 years. You know, you have a DEXA scan every 2 years. So I didn't take anything. And then my DEXA scan said, marked improvement on the right-hand side, no change on the left. So I sort of didn't take anything. Then I went back, and they said, you might need shots now. And I said, what? And they sent me to an endocrinologist who got my information from my gynecologist. They had me take new DEXA scans. It had been 2 years. And they compared everything, and I got a call. I was in a parking lot, and she said to me, your DEXA scan was so great, you're on a drug holiday for 2 years. So what does that say to you?
Well, it's a little hard to figure this out without actually having the information in front of me.
Yeah.
There could always be a little bit of bouncing around with these DEXA scans. They are a little bit operator dependent. So if the hip is rotated a little bit, you can get a reading that doesn't make much sense. And I have that happen every once in a while. And I say, listen, it doesn't make sense. I'm going to have to send you back and redo it or whatever. And so have these always been on the same DEXA machine or different machines?
No, the last one was on a different machine, actually.
Yeah, that's something else but also. I tell people to try to always get it done on the same machine, and hopefully that'll also be the same technician working with it, because there can be a lot of noise in the background on these things, and it can make the numbers look like they're bouncing around when they're not really bouncing around that much.
All right.
Well, I'm in very good shape, and I was doing things like jumping rope and hitting a heavy bag, and so I just assumed that I was fine. I went to an orthopedist for a shoulder replacement, and he said your bones are soft, so
okay.
I don't know. But thank you for listening.
Okay, well, all I can say is the most recent DEXA is usually the one that I believe. And
yes.
I'm a little less concerned, what happened so much in the past as to where are we now and what is the risk going forward for some sort of a fracture? And then
Like the idea of no medication for 2 years, a drug holiday?
Oh, we often do that. We'll treat people for 3 to 5 years.
Good.
And then if it looks like they've improved or at least not lost anything, we will give a drug holiday.
All right. Eileen, thanks a lot for the call. Another person who's been waiting a very long time. Emma in Sullivan County, you're on with Dr. Matthew Leining.
Hello. I have a tracheotomy, so this may be difficult. Bear with me.
Okay.
I got two questions. I'm a diabetic, and I shot myself with my insulin last night, and I hit a vein. So I'm wondering what happens when you hit a vein, when you insert the insulin.
Okay, we got you, Emma.
Yeah. It just means the insulin's going to work much more quickly. We actually can give insulin intravenously, and we'll do that in the hospital when people are severely hyperglycemic or have something called diabetic ketoacidosis. So the insulin per se going into the vein, it's just going to work very quickly.
My second question is, when you take the Ozempic, what happens if you do not have a gallbladder?
All right. Ozempic without a gallbladder. Okay, gotcha.
You might get sludge. In other words, the biliary system may have a little trouble handling that. There's not data that I'm aware of that says specifically, if you've had a cholecystectomy, you can't be on it or anything like that. They haven't had specific issues such as that come up. Okay. The gallbladder thing is probably because those GLP-1 analogs will slow down gastric emptying, and they just appear to slow down the whole GI system. And that's one of the ways that it helps, because it gives you more time to absorb your food, and that gives your pancreas, which makes insulin, a little bit more time to kind of react to the challenge of making more insulin.
All right, Emma, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. Very quickly, in a minute or less, what's ketoacidosis?
So this is something that people with type 1 diabetes or anyone who makes essentially no insulin is at risk for. We think of insulin as a glucose hormone, but it actually is involved in protein and fat metabolism. And so if you don't have insulin on board, if fat metabolism runs amok, all right, you can generate ketones, which are a byproduct of fat metabolism. They are acidic, and so you can get ketoacidosis, and that's life-threatening.
And so you're basically metabolizing your own body fat at that point? Oh, interesting. All right, let's go to Kingston very quickly. Lynn, you're on with Dr. Matthew Leining.
Thank you for taking my call. I have osteoporosis, and my endocrinologist wants to put me on Prolia, and I'm hesitant to go on it because of side effects. I had been on Forteo several years ago, and that helped me, brought me back up to osteopenia, but they said they can't put me on the Forteo anymore, because the insurance companies won't pay for it. Anyway, I'm wondering what other options I might have.
Okay.
To get my osteoporosis back up to osteopenia.
Right. So Forteo is an anabolic therapy that we have for osteoporosis. Most of the people that are treated for osteoporosis get an anti-resorptive therapy. And so that would be your Reclast, your Fosamax, et cetera. After we give the anabolic therapy for a limited period, like 2 years for the Forteo, in order not to lose the gains that you make, we then go to an anti-resorptive. So it is standard practice after Forteo to be put on an anti-resorptive, at least for a few years. You could go on a different anti-resorptive, something such as Reclast, but also more recently, they have allowed people to get Forteo a second time around or take it for a longer period of time. When the initial trials were done, people habituated to it. In other words, after about 16, 18, 24 months, the response to Forteo just leveled off. So they said, all right, let's give it for 2 years and then stop and we'll give the anti-resorptive. So for a while, people were doing that, then waiting a few years and giving a second course of Forteo, but that's off-label. The FDA had not approved that.
Uh-huh.
But now there is some additional data. So one of the options that may be available now is going back on Forteo.
Lynn.
Okay. That's interesting. The previous caller said something about doing a lot of jumping rope and exercises. Can that help with the osteoporosis?
Yeah, well, we're used to thinking of bone as a static compartment, but actually bone is not static. It just has a longer timeline. Skeleton will respond to exercise. So if you stress a bone in the direction, like when you're walking, the bone will build up strength in the direction of that stress. So anything where you're on your feet constitutes skeletal exercise.
Mm.
Riding a bicycle doesn't. Swimming doesn't.
Interesting.
But being on your feet is skeletal exercise. Now, interestingly enough, that exercise doesn't show up in a DEXA scan. It's not going to show up as an improvement in DEXA, so don't look for that. It's going to be It's going to be on the microarchitectural level, which we don't measure directly, except in research labs.
All right, Lynn, we'll have to leave it there. We're just about done here. Dr. Lining, email from Anonymous, and maybe we can answer this in 15 seconds. I recently heard of something called brittle diabetes. Is that a real thing, and is there a test to find out if you have it?
No, that's just a descriptive term that I don't like to use, and people are going away from it. The implication is that somehow the diabetes in that person is more variable and less susceptible to treatment. It is true that in longstanding type 1 diabetes, your response to hypoglycemia may lessen, and you may also get gastric delay, which makes meal absorption problematic. But I really don't like using that term so much.
All right. Well, I'm glad we ended the show with it then. Dr. Matthew Lining, great job. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
We have so many calls and so many emails that we did not get to. Again, let's do this thing again soon. Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, offering subspecialization, focusing on specific cancers at its Clifton Park, Albany, and Albany Med location, NewYorkOncologyHematology.com. Thanks again to Dr. Matthew Lining of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for being with us. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for all the emails. Many apologies if we didn't get to yours. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. Nice job, sir. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, here's a change of pace. We'll talk birds with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.